My pleasure, Ben.
All right, so how does this algorithm work?
Well, you know, there are nine factors that are used, and we're talking about the Arno public safety tool. It's basically an algorithm that looks at nine different factors, and it evaluates risk in order to determine whether someone should be released and under what conditions they should be released during the pretrial phase of the criminal justice system. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to move away from money bail, which really has no correlation with risk, and use a scientific tool that actually assesses the likelihood that people may reoffend while they have been released, whether they will commit a violent crime or a property crime, and what is the likelihood that they would be returning to court when they're supposed to. You know, the current system that we have in most jurisdictions that uses money as opposed to a risk assessment tool is basically, it creates a situation where if you can afford to bail yourself out, you can get out regardless of whether you're a risky person or not.
Sure.
If you're poor or you cannot afford bail, you could be in custody for days or even months in some jurisdictions without the opportunity to actually assist in your own defense, be able to go to work, stay in contact with your family. So
yes.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to get away from that process.
So tell me about some of the factors that are included here.
Yeah, so some of the factors, for instance, are the type of offense that we're talking about. Are we talking about a violent offense? Are we talking about a property offense? We're looking at the age of the individual at the time that the offense was committed. We look at their prior criminal history. We look at whether they have failed to appear in the past. So, like I said, basically there are nine factors that are looking at the individual's contact with the criminal justice system previously, and also they're looking at sort of the situation of the person in terms of age at the time of the offense, and they evaluate based on the offense that was committed, any prior criminal history, any prior incarceration, any prior failures to appear, and it puts all those things together and evaluates whether the person is going to be a risk for public safety if they get a pretrial release, and by that they're looking specifically at whether they are likely to commit a violent offense while they have been released or a property offense, and whether they're going to be coming back to court as they agreed to do. Given those factors, then there is the algorithm creates basically a numerical value that it provides assistance to the judge as well as the prosecution and the defense to evaluate if the person should be released, and if so, under what conditions. Should they be under supervision or should they be just freely released, or shouldn't they be released?
How do you think a judge should be using this and weighing this score that a person is getting?
Yeah, I think, you know, a judge is, you know, this would be a tool, right? And, you know, I would never suggest that a judge should just blindly follow the tool. You know, the tool is continuously being calibrated, but it's just another vehicle for a judicial officer to move away from money bail to actually assess the likelihood of risk of an individual and then make a final decision based on the totality of the circumstances. One of the things that we know, and I know people get very hesitant when you're talking about, you know, algorithms, or basically what you're talking about is a robot, you know, helping make a human decision.
Sure.
You know, people often like to believe that their intuition and their personal experience is far superior to what, you know, a tool like this can do. But the reality is that a tool like this is looking at hundreds of thousands of cases and has come up with this value system where us as a human being, even if we're very experienced, we would never get to be exposed to the amount of work that goes into the development of the tool. But nevertheless, you know, it is a tool. It is not the ultimate decision should be made by a human being, but I believe it really helps inform that decision and moves away from personal biases. You know, one of the things about our tool, the tool doesn't look at race, doesn't look at economic history, doesn't look at social history of the person. You know, it's totally blind when it comes to that process.
Some judges are using this. Some judges are not really using this. Are you disappointed by that, that some judges choose to not use it?
Well, I am, and you know, I think this is a new process for many people in the criminal justice system. And like, you know, any time that you bring in a new idea or any time that you bring innovation into an industry, you're going to have people that have been doing business in a certain way for many, many years, and it's going to be harder for some of those folks to move away from the past. You know, we are fearful of things that we don't fully understand. I think also, and rightfully so, most judges and frankly most DAs were very risk adverse by nature. And now you're being asked to put a great deal of trust in the system that you may not fully understand. And I think until this becomes normalized and people get more familiar and comfortable with the tool, there will be some folks that are going to be reluctant to use it, but it is disappointing because, you know, frankly, the system that we have today has not worked very well. You know, we arrest thousands of people daily in this nation. We incarcerate people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in pretrial confinement. And you know, what we have been doing for many years had a horrendous impact economically in the criminal justice system, both at the state, the local state, and the federal level. But frankly, more also has had a horrendous impact in certain communities, especially communities of colors and poor communities. And this is a tool that tries to begin a process of moving away from the past.
Yeah, and I, you know, you mentioned that the algorithm itself doesn't take some of these tricky factors in, like the person's race or their economic background. But some of these algorithms have been criticized as potentially compounding bias instead of protecting against it. Is there a danger of that here? Do you know yet?
Yeah, I think part of it, first of all, let me say that there are different tools out there. The tool that we're using doesn't include these factors. We know that there are other tools that do, in fact, consider some of those other social factors that we do not. So let me begin by saying that our tool, it doesn't do that. Secondly, the tool that we're using is funded by a nonprofit foundation, so there's absolutely no profit motivation behind the Arnold Foundation's tool.
Sure.
It is freely, is made available freely to any jurisdiction that wants to use it. So
they're,
I think
not,
it's
making
important
money
also,
off it. Yeah, no, I get that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but they're not making any money.
But humans are still making the algorithm itself, right? And there's going to be some inherent bias there no matter what, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, look, one of the problems for sure, even as we try to move away from, you know, becoming sort of closing the window on race when you're making this decision, the reality is that, for instance, one of the pieces or components that the tool uses is prior offenses and prior incarceration. Well, we know that often, members of minority communities, especially communities of color like the African-American community and the Latin community, people are subjected to a different attention by the criminal justice system, and some people may have prior criminal history that if they were perhaps more affluent or if they were not a member of the minority, they would not have for the same conduct. And when that is the case,
a white guy and a black woman could commit the same crime, and one of them could go to jail for it and the other one may not, and the algorithm only sees the first one, right?
And that is true, and that's why I said earlier that we still have a human component to it that has to make the ultimate decision, right? So the tool will definitely have some issues with the disproportionality, if you will, that the criminal justice system may have.
Sure.
Having said that, I think it's important to also know that the tool has been calibrated fairly well and has a high degree of predictability. So we know that while there is no question that there is still some inherent bias in the criminal justice system, and certainly a tool like this will pick up some of those biases, the other side of the coin is that the validation process that this tool has gone through has tried to account for that, and it has a high degree of predictability in terms of whether a person is likely to reoffend, and if they're going to reoffend, whether they will be committing a violent offense or whether they will show up for court or any other judicial hearings that they're required to. So while it is true that it's not perfect and there are areas that still need further calibration, It is also important to know that the tool has been validated to a high degree of certainty.
You're one of approximately 30 jurisdictions around the country that are using this. What recommendation would you give to other cities?
Well, I think that the first recommendation that I would give to other cities is that we as a nation need to move away from money bail system. It's a system that the federal government pulled away from some time ago. And as you indicated, there are about 29 other jurisdictions that are already moving in that direction. I would say that there is absolutely no correlation between money bail and providing for public safety. To the contrary, money bail can actually cause dangerous people to be released because they can afford to pay the bail, whereas people that are not dangerous may not remain in custody. And I think what I would urge people to do is to begin the process of evaluating whether it's this tool or another tool that would be a good fit for their community. And then, you know, go at it slowly, make sure that you have buy-in from other stakeholders. But I think that moving away from the money bail system is critical if we're serious about, you know, not only modernizing our criminal justice system, but quite frankly, becoming, less reliant on whether you can afford to get out of jail or not.
Some jurisdictions are also using algorithms for sentencing. Is this something that you're also considering in San Francisco?
Well, we actually do already. We have a tool that is used by the probation department. It's called Compass, which is used in many jurisdictions around the country. And it's a different tool. It's a post-conviction tool. It's a tool that actually, prosecutors wouldn't be able to use in the pretrial process because it actually looks at about 120 different factors. It requires an interviewing of the defendant with the consent of their counsel, and that is used as a guide for the probation department to provide sentencing suggestions to the bench. To the judge, and much like in the case of this tool, obviously both the defense and the prosecution can argue for or against the recommendations of the probation department. So we are using another tool for sentencing recommendations, but again, it's still at the end of the day, it's up to the judge to make the final decision with input from all the various stakeholders. This tool, though, that we're referring to is purely a pretrial tool. Is a very simple, quick-to-use tool, so it's a little different.
Your office has been pretty critical of law enforcement in your jurisdiction this year. Bias is an issue in the legal system as well, of course, as we've been talking about. What might you say to critics who suggest this tool you're employing doesn't make the system better and is just, I don't know, the latest technology fad in your area of work?
Well, I think that the first thing that I would say is let's look historically at where we are. If you look at the confinement of people for in pretrial status, it averages between 60% and 80% around the country. And then if you further look at who is being held, for pretrial conditions, they're mostly African Americans and Latino and poor people. And this tool, we believe, and we have seen it in the jurisdictions that are being used, it begins to reduce the impact on those populations, and it reduces the number of people that are being held for pretrial confinement. So while it is not perfect, we already have sufficient evidence out there that it's actually likely to reduce the number of people that are being held for pretrial confinement. So, you know, I would say that you need to look at where we are today, and if you're comfortable with where we are, I would venture to say that either you know very little about the system or you really don't care about the social and the economic impact that the current system has on so many communities. If you want to move forward, this is one of the ways that you can begin to explore alternatives to what we're doing today.
Are there any other areas that your office is looking to introduce algorithms to as part of the judicial process in San Francisco?
Well, you know, we not necessarily as part of the judicial process because we're beginning to use this process and we want to make sure that it gets properly calibrated and that we get it to work well for us before we start venturing in other areas as far as the actual releasing of people or sentencing, that, again, there's another tool for that. But we do use many other tools in our investigations. We use it to do what we call link analysis tools. So we try to identify people that we may be prosecuting for a particular offense and see whether they may be engaging other offenses that have not been necessarily attributed to that person. We do a lot of work around this area in human smuggling and human trafficking. We have identified, for instance, we had recently a case where we had one particular defendant that came to our attention because of his kidnapping and trafficking of a young female minor. And we were able to use some of our link analysis tools, which are basically algorithms, to identify two other victims. In fact, one of the other victims was in Texas. We were able to talk to her, bring her, and that enhanced the capacity of our case, and this individual received a much more severe penalty that he would have otherwise. We also use it sometimes in when we have serial offenders, like robberies or other offenses, where we may have enough information in one particular case, and we use some of the tools that we have in order to develop patterns of behavior that actually have led us to solve the crime and identify the offender or offenders. So we are, I would say that we're probably one of the most aggressive DA's office around the country in trying to learn how to use technology to do a much better job.
What happens if your job gets taken over by a robot? Do you have any concern about that?
No, you know, I don't. I think that...
I don't know how old you are or close to retirement, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm not close to retirement yet. I'd like not to be. but here's the thing. Look, I think that, first of all, the reality is that, you know, within the next decade, we're going to have, driverless cars, and we're going to, you know, we continue to bring technology to do work for us in many ways, and we believe that often this technology not only makes the quality of life for all of us better, but I think it makes for a safer community. I think that, you know, I believe that there will always be the need for a human being to oversee some of these functions. But, you know, frankly, relying on human intuition and our experience, while it has a value, also can have a tremendous negative impact in the way that we do. You know, I mean, if you talk about implicit bias, for instance, which is a problem that, you know, is plaguing the criminal justice system, both in the police and prosecution, even defense and the courts. Having tools that can navigate the impact of implicit bias and the decision-making process in the criminal justice system will be very good. So I think that what we need to do is we need to embrace technology. We need to understand that there will always be limitations to technology, and that at the end of the day, human beings are the ones that create the technology. But I like to embrace it and try to use it to the maximum that I can in order to improve the quality of the services that we provide.
So theoretically, you don't think a robot might be able to do your job better than you?
Well, I think a robot might be able to do a better job eventually than I in many areas, especially when it comes to deciding, how to charge a case, what kind of penalties to look for. Certainly in the introduction of, analytical work around other pieces of evidence, you know, especially when you're talking about serial offenders, we're already seeing that. You know, it would be impossible for me. I can tell you, for instance, in some of the cases that we have here, that we're analyzing multiple offenses around the region, you know, we have computers that can analyze hundreds of thousands of pieces of information in seconds. There is no way that I could ever do that. So to the extent that we avail ourselves of those tools, our decision-making process is going to be much better, and I'm not fearful of that at all. To the contrary, I welcome that process.
George Gascon is the district attorney for the city of San Francisco. George, thanks for talking to me.
Ben, my pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.